Ringworm, 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 my cellium phone. Ringworm, 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 my cellium phone. Check out this fungus. It's here among us. Oh, what's up, everybody? It's America's most natural podcast. The podcast that comes straight from the earth. I'm, my toes, Van Rossum.
I'm a Midsummer's Night fever dream, Ben Sheets.
Ooh, that's a good one.
That's a good one. Hi, I'm Cleveland Mosier, and it's mycelium, and I can cry if I want to.
Well, we're back with sort of an unofficial follow-up to our mid-year catch-up, because we're going to be talking about another new film. It is 2021's In the Earth, written and directed by Ben Wheatley, and it stars Joel Fry, Reese Shearsmith, Haley Squires, and Elora Torchia. Listeners who are wondering why Ben's audio sounds a little bit different than ours, Ben is joining us from the great state of Iowa, and we have not had a chance to talk about this at all with Ben. Cleve and I talked about it a little bit after watching.
But only briefly.
Wanted to save a lot for this episode. But, Ben, I'd be very curious just to hear your initial thoughts on this right off the bat.
First impressions, you know, going into this, I was a little nervous. Ben Wheatley is a director I find very hit or miss. I love movies like Sightseers and Kill List, but movies like High Rise and Free Fire didn't really do as much for me. He has kind of a mixed track record, but after watching this movie, I was extremely impressed. Mm-hmm. I really, really enjoyed this movie. Some of the deeper conceptual themes get a little silly and convoluted, but at its core, the meat and potatoes thriller and horror elements are really well executed, I think, and really fun and engaging.
Yeah, I would agree. I'm glad to hear that you enjoyed it as well, because I was thinking today, like, Cleveland and I were talking last night about how this may be our new favorite of the year so far.
I've thought about it.
And I think I might be right there with you. I think the course of this conversation is going to kind of determine that one way or another for me. But I was just sitting around my apartment today thinking, like, man, wouldn't it just figure if this would be a movie where we hop on and Cleveland and I love it and Ben hated it?
No, well, thankfully, I also loved it.
Yeah.
But even if not, it would have been good discourse, I think.
Yes.
I do think that before we get into, like, what the movie's about and start talking about specific things, I was doing some reading on it, and I was impressed to see that it was, from what I could tell, written and shot in the course of 15 days.
During
COVID. Impressive. Yeah, and which is extremely impressive. I mean, it's a very limited cast. There's only four central characters and then two other sort of ancillary characters who are at the very beginning. And they're all shooting on location, like out in the woods in the UK. It's really the perfect kind of COVID film, but like the turnaround time is what really impressed me, because
I'm staggered by that.
It's even if it was written before and the production itself took 15 days, like the amount that they were able to accomplish, like it's a very well thought out and meticulous film that does a lot of really, really cool shit. So like, to have it on the same kind of turnaround as something like Tammy and the T-Rex really puts things into a different kind of perspective.
What do you mean by that, Tees? Tammy the T-Rex is a masterpiece.
It's a different kind of masterpiece, Cleveland.
Yeah. Careful. You're treading on thin ice, Tammy the T-Rex.
I love Tammy and the T-Rex. I'm not disparaging Tammy and the T-Rex. But Tammy and the T-Rex is the kind of cocaine-fueled nightmare that I would believe was made in the span of 2 weeks, whereas something that is slower and very character-driven and high concept being done in that same amount of time, and effectively to boot, is quite an achievement. I'm with you, Ben, on Ben Wheatley. I haven't seen a ton of his stuff, but I liked Kill List and was not super hot on High Rise either. So, I mean, I was kind of going into this wary for that as well. But I was glad to see that the expectations set by the trailer were met by the movie. I remember watching the trailer and being like, that looks fucking awesome. And it was fucking awesome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's funny, I was logging this film on Letterboxd after I saw it a couple days ago, and I usually don't look at, try to avoid the general ratings before we talk about them, but I noticed it was like at a 3 or something. And I guess people really think this movie is slow and boring.
Yeah.
And that is so shocking to me, because I found this movie incredibly tense and engaging, and a lot of times pretty funny too.
Yeah, I would agree. I think I can see why the general public would think this is boring, in sort of the same way why I understand why people would think Honeydew is boring, based off of our last conversation. It's funny you mention it's Letterboxd rating. I was reading some articles and stuff, and I on Google, and if you just Google In the Earth, if you scroll down to the reviews section, the top voted tags across Google for this movie are boring, confusing, slow, and loud.
Man, I mean, it breaks my heart, but also that's really funny.
I get it, I guess, but, you know, like, for people who are maybe looking for a more kind of, like, high body count horror movie with, like, however many scares per minute, I can see this not meeting that expectation. I mean, it is slow, I think, and there's a lot of exposition, there's a lot of talking, and a lot of people find that shit boring. I thought it was awesome, because, like, the shit that they're talking about is very up my alley.
I want to make a comparison to Midsommar really quickly, because
it's an apt comparison.
Yeah, like, it's a psychedelic horror film that largely takes place during the daytime. What I would say is that Midsommar is like a visual feast, and this movie is just like a really, like, one course, clean, good, well prepped gourmet meal. Whereas like Midsommar, like, it's a fucking banquet, you know? And I think that both are great for their own rights, but also I just love to sit down.
This movie is
really
also
nice
about an hour shorter than Midsommar, too. So there's definitely something there. I made the Midsommar comparison in ways as well, but there are a lot of other movies that I like a lot that I was able to draw comparisons to. Annihilation's an obvious one.
Yes.
I got a lot of Arrival vibes, too, in the second half.
Yeah, I mean, in the second half especially, it gets almost hard sci-fi in a lot of respects.
And notoriously, you'll know how much I love that.
Wears its influences on its sleeve, for better or for worse, you know? I can definitely see through lines to stuff like Possessor or Mandy. Yeah. Like you said, Annihilation is an obvious one. Though I feel like it almost satirizes Annihilation in some ways. And we can get into that farther once we get into some of the plot details.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about what the film is about. So it is set in an unspecified time period, but it is set during a global pandemic. At the beginning, we see our characters wearing face masks.
Not very relatable at all.
Right. I like that they leave the pandemic unnamed. I think it'll make the film age better.
Yes.
To not say, like, hey, it's COVID. But
it's also like a really dark way to go about it, too, to imply that there could be more.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. Well, that's a whole other thing. But so it's set during a pandemic that is killing people globally. One of our protagonists, Martin, is a soil analyst scientist who goes out to sort of like a remote research facility deep in the woods to assist the research of one of his old colleagues, who it is implied and then straight up stated later that he was also in a relationship with. And she is, as we're told at the beginning, at least, she is out there to study mycorrhiza, which is, from my understanding, essentially sort of a symbiosis between fungus and like roots of plants to create sort of like an interconnected network of flora. And they're trying to research this to find more effective ways of growing crops, because, you know, pandemic times and whatnot. And so Martin meets up with Alma, who is a park ranger at the national park where they are doing this research. And they hike out into the woods to find Dr. Wendell. Is that her name? Wembley?
Wensleydale.
I
think it's Wendell, yeah.
Yeah, I think Wendell. And then, yeah. You know, once they sort of get way out there isolated in the woods, some very strange and creepy things start happening.
See the movie to find out.
Yeah, I would say if you're interested in this movie, going into it with just that little knowledge is all you need. I don't think this is a movie where spoilers will ruin the experience for you, but I definitely enjoyed the drip of information and sort of making discoveries along with the characters. So, you know, spoiler warning from here on out. If you want to see this movie untainted, I definitely recommend it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I agree
fully.
But
I don't think this is one you necessarily need to go in blind to.
No,
I think this is one where I think if I watched it a second time, I'd get a lot of things I didn't notice the first time out of it. So I think knowing some of that might not be a bad thing necessarily.
No, definitely not. Well, you mentioned earlier that in the second half it becomes hard sci-fi. And what I like about that is because in like the first half, it is the opposite. It is the threat is presented as supernatural, as superstition. You know, when Martin is first at the research facility before they set out into the woods, there's like an old wood cutting of like a local like folklore.
Parag Feig?
Parnag Fen.
That's it.
No, Parnag Feg. Parnag Feg.
That's it.
The only reason I remember that is because it reminds me, it made me think of the band, the Lord Weird Slow Feg. and so he learns that there's kind of like this superstition of like an ancient forest spirit that is like dwelling within the woods. And, you know, here's some stories about people like having gone missing in the past. And so it sets you up to believe that this is going to be something akin to like Seder, you know, something that we've talked about recently, where I went in thinking it's like, okay, we've got like a pagan god scenario on our hands. The people are going to be hunted down by this spooky forest spirit. And by the end, there it turns into something completely different and goes in mostly away from the supernatural and into more hard science. And I think the way that it pulls off that transition is really good, because that would be easy to fuck up, I think.
Yeah. I would say it's makes me hard science. That was some good shit. Like, that's exactly what I was wanting out of a movie.
Well, yeah. The one thing that I love about it is the film is essentially split into two parts in a lot of respects, right? You have the first half, which is kind of the Zach section.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the second half, which is kind of the Wendell section. And both of them are kind of distinct in a lot of ways.
And then, but then they're unified by the end.
Yeah, they're interconnected. Mm-hmm. But I think what's interesting to me about them, and part of the reason I mentioned it almost feels like a satirical play on like Annihilation or something like that, is if you follow their line of logic, either Zach's line of logic or Wendell's line of logic, like you can see this film as like full core or hard sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take what they're saying with a grain of skepticism, it just becomes Crazed People in the Woods.
Yeah.
Right. Like the whole section with Zach is, you know, this guy has been in isolation for too long and he's a man of faith driven to the edge, essentially. I kind of love how like it's poking at those heady ideas, but also kind of giving them the side eye in some ways. Yeah. And saying, should you really buy this shit?
Well, and like you say, on the other side of the coin, Wendell is a woman of hard science, but who has also been in isolation for too long. And one thing that I really like is that both she and Zach say individually to Martin and Alma, you should be more open-minded. I'm surprised you're not more open-minded. But in the context of their approach to this force that's in the woods, they each have a very dogmatic, closed-minded approach to it, because they're each so certain that it is what they think it is, and think that the other is crazy. Or misguided for thinking, you know, the opposite. And I think you're right that the film does a really good job of presenting both of those characters as people who have been driven to madness by isolation, and that they both think that they're right, but in reality, what is actually at play in the woods here is kind of a synthesis of each of their ideas. It's a combination of the natural and the supernatural in a lot of ways. And I think that the way the movie plays with that is really cool.
Yes.
It almost reminded me, going back to wearing its influences on its sleeve, it reminded me a bit of Prince of Darkness in how it kind of approaches kind of the supernatural environment
with the scientific. Film I keep thinking about ever since we watched it on the podcast.
Fucking slaps, man.
Whenever like I'm trying to make a connection with people online now, I send a gif of like, we are broadcasting from the year 1999 just to like get through to people. It's very fun. I've become like a huge fan of that film, and I was right off the bat from seeing it, but it's really stuck around in my memory. Prince of Darkness is a masterpiece. Mm-hmm. But
go listen to our episode on Prince of Darkness.
To reference something else that isn't a film but a part of pop culture, I think I'd be remiss without bringing up Joe Rogan bullshit. We do not have a young Jamie to pull up more stuff on mycelial networks, which is a thing that I've tuned out of Joe Rogan for a while now, but for years now he's been on the mycelial network train in a big way, so I wanted to sound a little more informed than Joe Rogan, and so I spent this morning playing back some documentaries on mycelial networks to come to this podcast a little fresh. Unfortunately, I'm still a big dumb brain, and
science is confusing.
And science is confusing, and I'm not going to try and come at this as an expert, but I guess in the end, I kind of failed. I'm just going to be coming at this like Joe Rogan after all, but I tried. but what I will say I did find very amusing is that the scientists that they interview for like these mycelial networks, and I tried to find like the ones that were about mycelial networks and approached it from a little bit more of like a straight-laced BBC perspective, and less the ones about like expanding consciousness, like, you know, sort of stuff, which is fine. Like, I don't have a problem with that, but it's not what I was trying to seek out. I was trying to seek out the science part of it, because it's me. Even then, the scientists who are studying like mycelial network systems, they all look like they have like they all have like crazy hair, and
they're all like the Ancient Aliens guy.
Yeah, well, not that far, but like they at least look like they've they've done experiments a few times, and they're kind of really, like, invested in the scientific element for, like, you know, those reasons. And I respect it. I respect that a lot. They all still look like they know what they're talking about. They're in labs. They're wearing coats.
That's all that matters. If I see a motherfucker in a lab coat, I'd say that dude knows what he's talking about.
And are a part of larger institutions that are slightly better, like, reviewed. But
what's your point?
Even then, they still look kind of, like, crazy, like Dr. Wendell. Which I thought was fun, but I did find some fascinating.
I think what you're really saying is that Joe Rogan is a scientist.
No,
think about it.
No, yeah. I've tuned out for a while. But one thing I did find fascinating is, like, there's a lot of theory on the fact that mycelial networks paved the way for the rest of life. When fungi, like, set out spores, it can land on, like, pumice. Like on volcanic rock, and it lets out like an acid, and then they send out their fibers into the rock, and they're nourished by the stone, and it breaks down the stone and turns it into like soil and soot and whatnot for soil for like plant life to you know make its way next, and then so that amphibians can make their way onto land, and so like it paves the way for life on land, and you know through that we're also nourished by it. And we are connected and attached to it.
Well, that's funny in terms of connection to the movie, because, you know, a big crux of this movie is the giant stone.
Yes.
The monolith.
Which, to describe to our listeners, is a large singular henge-esque stone with a hole in the middle of it. And our title sequence, and we're regularly called back to this shot of zooming in on the hole and the trees behind, and mm-hmm. it's the absence of a thing, right? Like it's this central space where something is filled, and I love that because that's so much of this movie, right? Is these characters have like a hole that they're trying to fill. They're trying to, you know, there's something mirrored back at them.
But also, when you look through it, it contains everything that you see through the hole on the other side.
Yeah.
So it's empty, but it's really not empty, is it?
Damn.
It's kind of got everything in it, if you think about it.
It does. Young Jamie, can you pull up everything?
Young Jamie's got to be like 40 years old at this point, right?
Yeah, he's got to be.
Like he can't be that young anymore.
Forever a Joe Rogan intern.
Yeah, he'll be 80 years old. Joe Rogan will be 106 or
Young
whatever.
Jamie! Young Jamie! You think Joe Rogan's going to last that long before... He can say anything, can't he? Cancel Joe Rogan.
Much like Parnag Fag, Joe Rogan is timeless and eternal.
Kind of a neutral entity. Yeah.
Let's talk about the stone a little bit more, because right at the beginning of the film we see stones being broken and one piece of a stone being put in the earth, quite literally. It was a really striking sequence, but it plays into a later scene.
Yes,
I love the payoff.
Kind of one of the first scenes of like physical violence, gore that we get in this film that I thought was really well done.
Yeah.
I thought all the practical effects in this movie were really well done.
Man,
that
fantastic.
One kind of stood out.
And like, I said earlier that, like, this movie does not have a high body count. But that being said, like, it does have quite a bit of violence and gore, too.
The foot trauma count is through the roof.
It's insane. Martin just, like, spends the whole movie having his foot absolutely annihilated.
Fucked.
Over and over again. But yeah, it's great. We start the film with seeing, like, these hands planting this little shard of stone into the soil and like having grass covered over it, and it's just like what's that, what's going on, right? And then partway into the movie, after their first, or it's their second night in the woods, Alma and Martin are attacked in the middle of the night by unknown assailants who smash all of their equipment and steal their shoes. And that's it. They don't take anything else. They just steal their shoes. So they're having to walk through the woods barefoot. And Martin, who is a city boy, who a nerdy city boy who doesn't know how, you know, doesn't know shit about nature or about being out in the woods, doesn't know how to set up a tent, has no survival skills whatsoever. He cuts his foot open real bad.
It was great too, because like when it happened, I was just like, "You idiot! Yeah. You fucking idiot! Well, what are you doing, Martin?" Because I was already like primed to hate Martin, like by design in the best way. Like the movie got me really good on it. I was already really tired of Martin by
his
then.
His incompetence is well established at that point, so it's like, oh, of course,
yeah,
he would fucking step on something and cut his foot open, and you know, so that sort of leads them to meeting Zach out in the woods, who, you know, initially appears as sort of like a friendly hippie type, long hair, bearded, you know, he's been out living in the woods to, you know, escape the pandemic and foraging off the land and stuff like that, and seems like a friendly guy, and then, you know, pretty quickly drugs them and starts doing some weird stuff that we can get into. But it's at that point that you realize that the stone that was planted at the very beginning was set up for that moment for Martin to step on it and cut open his foot.
Mm-hmm.
So that payoff is nice. So it's not really Martin being incompetent. Like, it was a trap that was set for them.
Yeah, anyone could have
fallen into it. It's like
it's well hidden.
Yeah, you're looking where you're going when you're walking through the woods barefoot, but you're not expecting like a little razor sharp piece of rock to be sticking straight up and covered in grass. Like, what looks like it's okay to be tread on.
It's so often a move I respect to present me with a character like I'm almost designed to hate, because like in the past I've gotten like less joy out of like non-resourceful characters. A good example is like my complaint over the beginning of The Empty Man, which is very personal. It's not a problem with the movie, but I love it when characters are resourceful, and I'd mentioned it in that episode, and this is such a beautiful example of it with like Alma's character is so on the fucking ball, and I just came to like just adore her character by the midpoint of this film. Because like she's constantly stepping in and like fucking saving the day. And with Martin at the beginning, like I'm as we've said, I'm primed to hate him. I'm just like, this guy fucking sucks. He's never been in the woods. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's going to weigh her down. I hate it when characters are stupid. And but Alma was always there as a wonderful foil to that. To me to be like, oh no, this character rules though.
She's the opposite of Martin, just mm-hmm. like Wendell is the opposite of Zach. There's lots of foils in this movie, and like, yeah, Martin is scientifically very intelligent because he's a scientist, but has spent his whole life in the city, has no survival skills.
High intelligence, low wisdom.
Yeah, high intelligence, low wisdom, and whereas Alma is a park ranger, so she knows these woods really well, she has spent a lot of time in them, she has a lot of survival skills. She is the one who is always taking action in the film, where Martin doesn't want to do anything because he either doesn't know how or he's scared to. And I love that they cripple him very early in the film to make him even more useless. Like, he does nothing substantial this entire movie, but he's still an important character.
He earns our respect by the end of it.
Well, he earns our sympathy.
Yeah,
doing various heroic acts, even if he is not the most street smart, so to speak.
Well, tree smart.
Yeah, like, well, even like when it comes to the heroic acts, like Alma has to convince him, or let's it might be his idea, but Alma has to follow through on it. And I liked that about it, because it reminded me of how Ripley becomes the protagonist over the course of Alien. And I felt that Alma's character was very similar in that respect. Our frame is centered around Martin to begin with, but by the end of the film, it shifts to Alma deservedly, and she earns like the center of the film, and that ruled. I love it when, you know, like a protagonist like earns that central place. It was really gratifying.
All the character arcs are really well designed in this film. I think of like our first meetup with Zach, and kind of how he seems like an offbeat but benevolent sort of hippie, and we're taken to his gigantic tent fortress.
Yeah.
where he has, you know, rummaged food. He brings out a guitar at one point to play them some music, and he's, you know, treating Martin's foot. And it's not until a little bit later that you realize, you know, everything's going very, very wrong.
Well, he gives them some tea and they drink it and start feeling lethargic and sleepy. And it's like, ah, you fucking fell for it. You drank something that a stranger out in the woods gave you, you fucking idiots.
Mm-hmm. And I like it too, because they're already desperate and hungry, yeah, and whatnot. So like, it's quite believable that they would fall for it. But there is a great tell. And that's that he has shoes.
That he has spare shoes to give them, yeah. Well, and also because, like, he says to them is, like, yeah, somebody out here attacked me a few days ago, you know, and I fought them off. It's like, oh, yeah, well, we got attacked last night in our tents. That's why we don't have shoes. And it's like, oh, well, I've got some spare shoes you can wear. It's like, wait a second.
Where did he get them?
Yeah. Well, I love that when he gives them the tea and they're drinking it, and that's when he brings out the guitar. And I even made a comment. I was like, he's one of those guys. Like the dude to just break out a guitar without anybody asking. And I was like, oh, fuck. You know, he's one of those dudes. He's gonna just whip out the guitar and start singing Kumbaya or whatever. But it's like, then he's sitting there and he's just kind of like tunelessly plucking the strings, like not playing anything, as like the drugs start to kick in and they start to get lethargic, and we realize like, oh shit, Zach is not what he seems. Zach is sinister. That whole sequence after they pass out is incredible. Because we just sort of watch what Zach does to them without the context that's added later. And it's so creepy and bizarre because he dresses them in these like sort of medieval gowns that he's just made out of like tarp, and like covers their eyes with little pieces of white paper and arranges them on the ground with like runes and stuff with sticks that he's made, and he just takes a bunch of pictures of them. And in his tent compound, he has like a dark room, so we see him developing the pictures, but like that's all he really does to him at first. It's like, and then he lets them wake up. It's like, what the fuck is going on here? He just knocked them out to like play pagan dress up and take some pictures.
Yeah, and like it seems clear too that like he's doing it from like in his action, it appears ritualistic. It doesn't,
yeah.
So you know, like it's not like a Cosby thing. Like it's not like a sexual thing necessarily, or it's implied it isn't, which makes it like equally strange. Because it's like, okay, well, if it's not that, what?
Yeah.
And I enjoyed like, yeah, the questions that raised. To paint a picture of this man for our audience, as soon as he came into view for the first time, I said, oh, it's Tommy Chong. Wait, but also kind of Cheech. Like this guy looks like the perfect fusion of Cheech and Chong.
He does.
I really like his role, like his delivery too. Like it's very dry.
Yeah, he's yeah, great. And you know, he becomes kind of the central villain for the rest of the film. Because, you know, after they wake up, he sort of starts, then we get a lot of exposition, where, you know, he's talking about like, oh, you know, he's worshiping this forest spirit thing. And that's why he's taking these pictures and stuff, because he wants to speak to the spirit with art and with worship and with idolatry. Like that's the way to speak to it. So he's just out here like making creepy art to communicate with like a pagan forest spirit. Or at least that's how it's presented at the time.
It's funny because, you know, there's some foreshadowing to the second half where he talks about that, and he talks about how Wendell is trying to reason with it, and it's something that can't be reasoned with.
Can't be reasoned with. Yeah, exactly.
But it can be appeased.
Yeah, it doesn't want bargaining, but it wants worship
and sacrifice.
And we get this interesting like lore backstory. He says that like it told me its story. It was a sorcerer that was like an ancient sorcerer.
Like a necromancer.
Yeah, who was persecuted by the village that he lived in or whatever, was chased out into the woods and fused his essence in with the standing stone. So
well,
like
what he said is that I think if I remember correctly, he said that people have said it's that throughout history, but it is more. Like, some people say it's a necromancer, some people say it's this, but it is deeper than that. Like, it is, like, this eternal source, if I remember correctly.
Well, according to him, the story that it gave him is that it was wrongfully persecuted as an alchemist and a necromancer.
Mm.
Right. But that it did have a human origin, and then it transcended into something more, and became this sort of like spirit of the forest,
into earth.
It comes from the earth.
Yeah, I mean, at the same time, you have to take what he's saying throughout this whole monologue as kind of in a somewhat unreliable narrator.
Oh, yeah, not even a grain of salt, like a whole salt lamp.
Telling, you know, telling these drooling, catatonic characters that, you know, Martin and Alma are drugged the hell up and basically just catatonic, just staring at him, not able to move whatsoever. And some of it you can take, you know, seriously, but on the other hand, you can see it as, you know, this guy's just gone crazy in the woods for too long by himself.
Well, it's the same thing as any religious zealot, you know? Like you can believe that he believes it, like his conviction is obvious, but that doesn't necessarily mean that what he's saying is empirically true. You know, it's just like any religion, everything that he believes is based entirely on faith. You know, he's saying that he's being told the story of this spirit, you know, through supernatural and magical processes. So, I mean, you should always immediately take anything that somebody like that says with a grain of salt. But it's not important, like, whether he's right or not. It's important that he believes it, you know?
Yeah, and that's where the core of, like, the success of the first half, I think, lies in, is I think at its core, it's, you know, a misery-esque meat and potatoes kind of escape the crazed psychopath thriller. Yep. And I think it's super effective at that. You know, it's very, very tense throughout. You really sympathize with Martin and Alma trying to escape. The whole scene where Zach decides he needs to amputate some of Martin's toes is just,
oh my
just
God,
completely harrowing.
The conversation between them is so good too, like the way he doesn't just go at it, he kind of convinces Martin that it's the thing that needs doing.
He's like, oh yeah, your foot's infected, so I gotta amputate. It's like, I could take you to the hospital, but we're 30 miles from civilization, it could take days, you know, like the infection might kill you by then. And he's like, well, what's the alternative? It's like, oh yeah, well, we gotta amputate, and
it's all right, we just gotta get some toes off.
Yeah, we just gotta take some toes, like, no big deal, like, don't worry, my axe is really sharp.
Which was great, too, because it had, like, teeth, and I, like, shouting at the screen, like, but wait, it was the bottom of the foot that's cut, why do you need the toes?
Yeah, the wound is on the sole of his foot, like, why is the infection just in the toes? Like,
and the answer is he doesn't need it for that, like, it's not about the amputation, it's about the bits, he needs the elements.
He wants the toes for one of his weird rituals. You know,
the game is afoot.
But then, even like the ooh.
Hey, no reason to tiptoe around it. All right, you know.
even the amputation is so harrowing too, because it's like he takes the first couple of swings and misses, and it's like, that's just to get my aim, you know? So it's like every time he swings the axe, it's like you flinch with Martin, like, oh, is this gonna be the time that he does it? And then
you just can't tell if he's playing with him or not, or if he just is a bad swing. I couldn't figure it out, and I loved that.
Well, yeah, and then he gets a couple of them, and he's like, oh, well, you see, you move too much. Now I have to do more. I was gonna get them all at once, but because you flinched, I only got a couple of them. So it's like then he just takes another fucking swing, and it's like it's all done practically, and we see all of it. Like it's not a clean, neat amputation by any means. Like it is. It's grotesque.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, like the tension that builds up of that scene, like it is amazing. Like it lasts a good while, like, and there's a lot of time before, like, he finally lands that cut while they're all talking to each other. Like, it's a real toe burner.
Oh, all of that just for that. Fuck. Well, I want to talk about the sort of transitory scene between the Zach half and the Wendell half, because they do escape. They find a way to cut the ropes that are binding them, and then we get a really great sequence of Zach chasing them through the woods with an axe like a true slasher villain. But they quickly start to get into Wendell's territory, and we notice this when we start seeing, like, speakers lashed to trees and shop lights that are, like, covered in plastic tarps and stuff. And as night starts to fall and Zach is chasing them and Martin's like crawling through the ferns because his foot's all fucked up, it starts to get darker, and the light stand start to strobe, and like we start to hear noises, sort of quasi-musical sounds being blasted out of these speakers very asynchronously, and it gets really fucking like psychedelic and trippy. I thought that scene was incredible.
The way that they intercut like the weird like algae blooms like into the like the dark moments of the strobing. I think that they use like lighten layers as well, so that like the shadow play was still like the scene itself, like the forest or the people running. But like in the shadows, like you have these like weird blooms and stuff. Like there's some really cool layer effects you can do. And it's so quick. They do such a good job of sneaking up on it. Like they don't blow their load too early. Like that scene is incredible.
Like, also, like I just kept thinking, what a cool, clever way to light a scene, to like have your lights be part of the actual set, so you don't have to hide the lights, and that way you can get these really interesting kinds of lighting scenarios that you do not expect out in the woods, you know? It was such a cool idea to like make that part of Dr. Wendell's setup, because like, man, the part of the reason that scene is so effective is because of how striking the cinematography is, because of like these weird motivated lights. Mm-hmm. I thought that was incredible.
Yeah, and it's paired with this really frenetic handheld camera style through a lot of that scene, and it just becomes so disorienting at a certain point.
Yeah.
That you kind of lose track of space and time in some respects.
Well, and like,
and it boomerangs the way that like psychedelic drugs do.
And it seems like, yeah, it seems like the lights and the sound are having like sort of a negative effect on Zach too. Like it starts to kind of like drive him crazy. Like it's
like a feedback loop.
Yeah, it will, and it's, you know, that's how hypnosis works too. When you hypnotize people, you do it with like flashing lights and sounds and stuff like that. Like, and you know, that's how epilepsy works too. And like, it's cool that that serves to sort of like drive Zach away, as like this combination of like strobing light and sound, and it just like pushes him back into the woods. And so they can meet Dr. Wendell, who, you know, seems friendly enough. You know, she knows Martin. They used to date. Well, and also, it's, we haven't talked about it yet, but it's revealed shortly thereafter that that Zach is Dr. Wendell's ex-husband. So that gives their relationship a cool dynamic, how they know each other and how they've sort of become these two different sides of a coin. I liked that.
Yeah, I love the juxtaposition and interconnectedness of those two, you know, and like, for example, Zach is very much a man of faith, but he has the scientific element in his photo lab, right? Mm-hmm. He develops this film. It's a very specific chemical process that he has mastered and trained for. Meanwhile, we discover that Wendell is definitely a woman of science, but there is some faith and artistry to her methods, as we soon discover.
Yeah, I mean, she's got a big synth that she uses to try to communicate with this forest entity.
Yeah, man, it was at that moment too. I felt like, I think I said, I leaned over to Thies and I said, like, it did we make this? Did we all make this movie in a separate timeline? It's just, it has so many elements, like artistic tropes and themes that like we play off of in our own work too. Like, I feel remiss without mentioning it too, because like they pull from like the was the Malefus Maleficarum, is that right?
Yeah, we'll get into that.
The Hammer of Witches and like the plays with like incorporating science and also like ancient like forest magic, and the synth play on top of that. It was so many themes. We love psychedelic horror. It stirs back our own game of psychedelic horror, and it was just neat to see like such a like a sister work. Like I really thought that was neat. I was like, yeah, like these themes are like so up our alley. It's ridiculous.
This movie for us pushed all the right buttons. I definitely think so.
I did have a good giggle when Wendell introduced her synth setup.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
She was blasting this sick modular setup.
Yeah, rate her setup, so Ben. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Yeah, what are your thoughts on her
tech?
Well,
it's just basic, you know, side waves and stuff that she's blasting, but she's playing it so fucking loud in the woods.
Yeah.
That it's kind of amazing.
And she's doing it, like, so deadly seriously, too. Like, that's how I think you can really see early on that, like, Wendell is not a super trustworthy figure either. Like, Alma is clearly very mistrustful of her. You know, Martin trusts her implicitly because, you know, they used to be a couple, and, you know, he probably still loves her and trusts her.
And he's a fool.
And he's a fool, you know, like, once again, he's a fool. And
by design.
But like this whole like modular synth setup that she has going on, like, it makes her seem to be a crazy person. Like, she's approaching it all very scientifically, but it definitely seems like big bonkers, you know. Especially when she does pull out, as you alluded to, Cleveland, the Malleus Maleficarum, the Hammer of Witches, which is a real book, published in, I think, the 1400s. It basically outlined the ways in which to torture suspected witches to get confessions out of them and then to burn them at the stake. It was basically the witch hunter's handbook. Wendell has found a pretty much complete translation of it that makes reference to this Parnag Feg spirit of the forest. And she says, like, oh, when you break down the Latin of the name, it's like Parnagus and Feg mean sound and light. So she, you know, as studying mycelial networks as she does, knows that that fungi do communicate with bioluminescence and with sort of subsonic sound. So she says, oh, well, Pernag Feg is not a spirit. It is a sort of like vast interconnected forest organism. It is the forest, basically. And so she wants to try to communicate with it scientifically, but she says for some reason the following the rituals outlined in the Hammer of Witches gives the best effects. That if you follow those rituals, she's had the most success.
Best
so
deal.
Even though it's not scientific, you know, that's her going on faith too, you know. But that's the point where we turn away from like the necromancer who was hounded by you know, the townspeople and had his essence absorbed into the woods.
Which is also like, very similar to like Merlin's origin story in Arthurian legends as well. Which I thought was quite cool, because Merlin is largely built out of like much even more ancient like pagan and Druidic folklore. And he's the one who like understands the Fae and the rest as well. And there's some cool like mythos like tangentially related to that as well.
Yeah, it's cool stuff, and I like seeing the same sort of subject being presented from the opposite end of the spectrum as what we've gotten with Zach so far. It makes more logical sense what Wendell is saying, largely, but even so, like, she's still the same kind of zealot that Zach is, just from a different perspective.
Yeah, and I think the addition of the mycelial networks is really interesting, because much like Prince of Darkness, you can then kind of view both Wendell and Zach as almost sort of vessels for this deeper, more arcane kind of entity.
Mm-hmm.
And they both see themselves as vessels in that respect, too. They see everyone as a vessel. Like, Wendell sees, like, Martin and Alma's appearance as, like, by design. You know, she makes note
of
that.
Well,
it's like, wow,
I mean,
you're really supposed to be here.
That's the opportunity for us to bring up the ringworm, which I think contrary to, or a common misconception is that ringworm is an actual worm. No, it's a fungal infection. And it's mentioned at the beginning that Martin has recently recovered from a bout of ringworm, and we see when his first night in the woods, like, he has a patch on his arm that he keeps itching that appears to be the ringworm coming back. But Wendell mentions later, when she says, like, you were drawn here, you were brought here, she's like, did you have ringworm recently? And he's like, yeah, a few months ago. She's like, me and Zach did too. So this idea that this vast arboreal sort of consciousness is like using like a fungal infection to draw people to it, to bring them out into the woods.
It's amazing too, because like once again, going back to those documentaries and whatnot that I was mm-hmm. watching about this, like,
well, we know that
our evolution as a species was like largely like fungal instances, like in our diet, in our like influenced our psychology as well, and that like this is like something we are like physically connected to.
Well,
like the
we...
way that we process like booze, for instance, like is affected you know, by that, like in our biology, like in our evolutionary biology, like it acted like as a fulcrum for a lot of like things.
Well, and we know that that certain types of funguses are capable of literal mind control.
Mm-hmm. Cordyceps,
yeah, which, you know, has famously influenced the Last of Us zombie apocalypse. But like, that's just real. Well, ants will get infected and they'll be compelled to return to the hive to bring the infection back, to release the spores and infect the entire hive. So like the idea of these mycelial connections is you know, something that is, to a degree, based in real science. And I think that's why conceptually this movie is so cool. And I mean, you know, to get into the more hippy dippy aspects of it, like psilocybin, you know, magic mushrooms is a fungus, and it's, you know, processed in a certain way and, you know, makes you trip. But when you're tripping, you feel like you're connected to the universe and connected to the other people that you're tripping with. And that,
well,
like,
there's a lot of, like, you know, like emerging science and like positive statistics, like involving, you know, utilizing like, you know, psilocybin to like alleviate trauma,
man.
And, you know, other things.
I've heard of people being able to like break addictions to like cigarettes and stuff and alcohol through like regimens of microdosing psilocybin. I'm pro psychedelics for sure. But I was saying when we
were
watching
this movie, it is an emergent
field
worth noting, you know, like,
of course,
who's to say.
We're not
scientists. More science come out, but it is cool to read about for sure. I hope.
I do think this movie would probably be bad to watch while tripping, though. I think it would be very scary.
Yeah,
because the psychedelic aspects of
it
are
much of an assault on the senses.
Yeah.
For a trip.
Well, that's the thing. Like, that's why I think it's such effective psychedelic horror, because it uses those kinds of like bad trip. I don't want to say tropes.
The movie,
like,
trips for you.
Yeah, it does, and in a different way from Midsommar. You know, like Midsommar's also a psychedelic horror that's a very bad trip, but like this is different. It's more like an internalized trip, I think. And it's done really well, but the whole time I was thinking, I was like, man, if I was tripping, I would be so scared right now. Mm-hmm. I would be having such a bad time.
We have the most literal trip, in a sense, with the fog
that
appears around the camp. And I want to talk about that a little bit, because I think as a plot element, it works really well, but also kind of that whole sequence where Alma tries to escape is incredibly psychedelic and
favorite.
Effective.
It's my favorite scene in the movie.
Yeah, well, we see all of these little mushrooms around Wendell's camp in the night, releasing spore clouds. And when they wake up in the morning, the whole camp is surrounded by like a ring of mist. And Wendell's like, oh yeah, we've seen this before. Like, it's the mist is fungal spores, and, you know, it has a bad effect if you try to walk through it. And so Alma does. She tries to use Wendell's hazmat suit, even though Wendell says, like, well, what if the spores are smaller than 0.3 microns or whatever? Like, then the gas mask won't help.
Good science.
And sure enough, like, that's what happens, because Alma tries to escape and is overwhelmed by the fungal mist and has, like, a very, very bad trip. Where, you know, when Martin pulls her out and she's kind of like broken down, weeping and blubbering. And
they play with time in the coolest way too. You hear Martin like talking to her before she's even like fully like entered that. Like, yeah, they do some cool stuff like playing with audio.
Well, he asks her, like, what did you see? And she says, everything. I saw everything. And like, you know, that can definitely certainly be a symptom of just like a regular bad trip. But I also love that, like, she's experiencing like a taste of the consciousness of like this vast interconnected network of like the woods, everything, like the whole earth. So she's, you know, getting a little bit of that, and she is literally seeing everything. And that, like, the fact that she's even cogent for the rest of the movie after that is astonishing, because that, like, that's true Lovecraftian horror right there, where, like, you experience something that is so incomprehensible to your tiny brain that it just shatters your sanity.
Yeah. She just barely passed her will save.
Yeah, just barely.
And, no, I like that. But it's cool, too, because, like, they've been dosing, like, like throughout this movie, right? Or they've been dosed. So like they're building up tolerances to it. And also too, like when it comes to mushrooms, I've never done them, but like it if I had, I sure would think it was neat how effectively they showed that idea of it boomeranging, you know, because like you can be walking through the woods and feel fine and very psychedelic and fun, and the next moment, like, you're just kind of curled up in a ball on the ground as your body just feels like it's being pulled deep into the mud, and then it leaves again, and you can get back up and go back about like doing whatever and enjoying the psychedelicness of it, and then you return back to the soil, and it comes and it goes, and you see that in our protagonist.
It comes from
the earth, yeah, right out of the earth.
It's cool. It comes right from the earth, don't worry about it.
and I like this too, how our protagonists are a little bit more trusting because of it, because, you know, like they're on psychotropics, like they're a little more willing to kind of shrug aside things. And Alma still has that trepidation there, which I like. I like to think that she would have been like a lot more pressing about their survivability, like if she hadn't been tripping. And even still, like, she pushes like when she needs to, and I love that. Like it's perfect. But one more note on that scene, because she says my favorite thing in the movie in that bit, and I'm gonna have to paraphrase. I don't remember it exactly, but it is that she says it's not human. Right, help me out here.
She says it's not human. It looks like a human. It's pretending to be a human, but it's not. It's not human.
And I love that, because so much of psychedelia is pareidolia, which is the circumstance where you see things in patterns that aren't what they are, like faces in trees and such, right?
Well, either Zach or Wendell mentions that explicitly at one point. I can't remember which one, but they even say it's like it's a negative side effect of the human brain is to try to impose meaning or to impose a story where there is none.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't use pareidolia by name, but like
by definition
they describe that concept, and it's cool too, because you do get the impression, especially by the end, which we should get into shortly, that like whatever this thing is, it is trying to communicate with these people. It has brought them here for a reason, and it is trying to reach out and touch them. So it would make sense also for them to say, like, it's pretending to be a human, but it's not, because it's trying to put on the closest thing it can to a familiar face in order to communicate with them. But it's so vast and unknowable that it can't do that.
But what I like, Ben touched on it earlier too, what I really like is that everything about it is circumstantial. There is nothing that directly says it actually did those things in it. Like, the ringworm is... could be circumstance.
Sure.
They all work in fungal stuff.
They do.
Like there are all sorts of reasons you could put it aside, but when you add them all together, it feels undeniable, but really it isn't. And I prefer that about it. I think that makes it even better, is that room for doubt.
The climax where they're performing like the final ritual or whatever, like we do see on Wendell's computer, she has like mapped the mycorrhiza bed or whatever she calls it, that's extending out from beneath the standing stone, and like you can see that it is responding to the light and the sound, and it is like creating sort of corresponding patterns.
Well, those tests have been done in this reality to show that, like, trees do use mycelial networks to communicate to each other. There's a TED talk about it that's great, and I think it's along the lines of like the woods speak to each other or something. I forget the full title, but the scientist in that, like, she breaks down how she used like radiology and stuff to like get these trees to talk to each other by saying like, oh, I need more light, I need less light, this hurts, you know, like that's a thing that plants do. They do speak to each other, and they can like communally wilt in pain. There's lots of cool stuff.
That's what the smell of freshly cut grass is the grass basically sending a chemical warning to surrounding plants like, hey, there's something here that is going to cut you.
And damn, those screams smell so good.
But it, like, also at the same time, it's like, what's the rest of the grass going to do? Run away? Like, like, I don't know how good those...
I want
those,
my grass afraid.
Like, I don't know how good those chemical signals are. Like, what's the grass can't really do nothing about it.
Well, it can you know, like, hold nutrients, you know, like, instead of, like, using them. Like, there are things that it can theoretically do. I don't know enough about it to get much beyond that.
All I'll say is grills love me, grass fears me.
we should talk about the very ending of the movie a little bit.
Sure. Well, one thing I love right before the very end is we kind of discover that Wendell is not quite the woman of science that she seems in some respects. You know, it's revealed that she's kind of working with Zach and Zach's working with her. I really love the sequence where Alma wanders into it's Alma that does it, right? That wanders into the tent.
Yes. Yeah. And sees that Wendell has explicitly kept them out of that tent. She says it's a sterile environment, and I don't need outside pathogens going in.
Which is cool because it isn't a scientifically sterile environment, but it is a it is sterile to her beliefs.
Sure,
like, and it needs to be preserved, and she doesn't need their outside, like, negative ideologies, like, interfering with that environment. So to her, that's still the reality, which I like.
Totally. Well, we see the inside of it, and it's sort of Wendell's, like, ultimate synth setup in that tent. But the walls and ceiling are covered in Zach's photographs.
Look at this photograph!
Oh, fuck. So, it's revealed, you know, at that point that, like, Zach and Wendell have been working together all along. Even though they don't explicitly agree on what they're trying to communicate with, they do share the common goal, and I think that by the end they realize, and what they're trying to accomplish, is that the synthesis of their beliefs is going to yield the best results.
Synthesis. Because synthesizer.
Also photosynthesis, am I right?
Hey, because photos, that's good. Photo and synthesis.
And also trees and grass and plants and stuff.
Yeah, that too. You know, it's cool.
It's
all connected,
it's got,
man.
It's got layers.
Yeah, like an onion.
Like the earth.
The earth. onions are in da earth, so
onions come from da earth too.
It really is all connected.
It's all connected, man. We're all connected. It's one big dumb mycelial network.
And an onion
inside of an onion inside of a turtle's brain in space.
Yeah. And a spitting top.
That's right.
No, it rules. One thing I'll say too is I like that it's not it's sort of presented to us, like, almost awkwardly, like her stumbling into the tent. She's like, yo, wait, you're not supposed to be here. There isn't, like, a huge musical sting, I don't think, or at least, like, a dramatic choir moment there with her finding it. And nor should there be, because it's pretty well alluded to, if not directly, like, noted that they're working together. Like, it's kind of the only option at that point. Like, first off, they at some point were fucking. It's her ex-husband. He doesn't hurt them for a little while. Like, he doesn't show up in the camp when he has every option and ability.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is, like, what, like, keeps him away? Like,
nothing. Yeah. Like, I guess respect? I don't know. And he's a literal axe murderer at that point. And lastly, too, he does make an appearance, a very dramatic one, where he lights a flare in the distance.
Yeah.
And she says, no, it's cool, I'll go talk to him. She does and comes back. We, the audience, don't hear what she says. It can only be nefarious.
Of course. I think we called even before before, I think you and I called Cleveland even before Wendell appeared on screen. Like, when they first were introduced, Zach, it's like, oh yeah, they're working together.
Yeah.
Like, that's not, it's barely a revelation.
No.
And I don't think it's supposed, I don't think it's supposed to be a twist or anything, you know? But
no, and I appreciate the movie doesn't try and, like, sign it as one.
But their final ritual to try to communicate with this entity is a synthesis of Wendell and Zach's beliefs. She, you know, wants to put Martin next to the stone and then use the lights and sound to communicate. And, you know, but he has to consume a sacrament, Zach's words, which is, you know, just a little milky drink of some ground up mushrooms, almost certainly the psychedelic kind.
Mm-hmm. The same that they've been drinking largely.
And I'm then, sure. And then it's revealed too, like, that, you know, Zach wants to sacrifice, Martin upon the stone, you know, as a sacrifice to what he considers a deity. So like the combination of Zach and Wendell's beliefs coming together at the end is very cool and satisfying, and it leads to a sequence that reminded me very much of the alternate cut ending of Phase 4, Ben.
Yeah.
It's got the same kind of vibes. I could also see another reason people don't like this movie is that, like, there's not, like, a big action end sequence where, like, a spooky forest ghost appears and kills them, or they have to do, you know, some kind of exorcism to drive it away. Like, they...
Thank God.
You know, Alma kills Zach to save Martin, which is great because she, like, drives
love
a,
that scene.
She, like, drives a tent stake into his eye.
Yeah, he almost gets her with the knife and she comes back up with it. Again, yeah. Like, just her being, like, super resourceful, like, once again.
Gets him in the eye with a tent stake, and he like, tries to, like, he stumbles back and he, like, tries to pull out. He's like, wait, I've got, hang on, wait a second. Okay, no, I'm going to need you to take me to a hospital.
Yeah.
And then she...
After all yeah, that!
Well, I mean, the calling back to the amputation scene where it's like, well, I could take you to a hospital, or I could just amputate your toes. And then, you know, Alma responds by hitting him in the
just
face.
Just being like, fuck you!
And driving the stake the rest of the way into his brain.
Just doing what we all were feeling.
Yeah, which is so great, but I mean,
really,
I love
gratifying
that.
Death.
I fucking love that moment. It's like, wait, I'm going to need you to take me to a hospital. Like, after all of this. Yeah, it's so,
so
funny.
Good. It's such
but
a good bit.
I also kind of read it as then, like, Zach sort of becomes the sacrifice in place of Martin. Because, you know, when he's holding the knife to Martin's throat earlier, he says, like, I wish it could be me. Like, I wish I could be the sacrifice.
Lucky you.
But I offered myself and it wouldn't take me. You know,
but who does take him? Alma.
Yeah. And I think it works too, because, like, that he becomes a sacrifice, because after that moment, all three, Martin, Alma, and Wendell, are sort of seized by a shared, like, intense hallucination or communication with, you know, whatever this thing is. They have
and it's gorgeous.
They have a combined trip, and this just goes on for a few minutes, and that's why it reminded me of Phase 4, because it's very ambiguous, it's structureless, it's just, you know, visuals and sound, and it doesn't explicitly say anything. Like, we don't hear, like, a voice from beyond. And I mean, this is all to the film's credit. Like, I think it would have been, if it had been less abstract, it would have been much less successful. But to go back briefly, the reason that Wendell wants to communicate with this thing is because she's convinced that it wants to teach them how to basically live in harmony with, you know, man and nature and not destroy the planet and so on.
And she's
so
ready to murder Martin to learn about how to
for sure. Well,
peace.
I mean, it's a sacrifice. It's worth it, right? Like the death of one for the good of the many, you know? But, you know, even Zach earlier in the film says that, like, our humanity is what has driven us away from nature, that we, you know, we march to the beat of human society, which is different than the beat of the earth. So, like, in order to be able to communicate with something like this, you have to separate yourself from humanity.
You gotta get into earth.
And I think that it is, it's interesting too, because the reason that these rituals, I think, are outlined in The Hammer of Witches is because that was written not too long after, like, the Black Death in Europe, another time of plague. They're in a time of plague now, and I think that this, the earth, the forest spirit or whatever, is trying to reach out to humanity in times of great catastrophe to bring them enlightenment, so on and so forth. And the way the film ends is, you know, they all come out of their trance and Alma goes back to Martin and she kind of stands over him and she just says, "I'm going to lead you out of the forest." And then it cuts to credits. And, I mean, of course you can take it literally. Yeah, she's going to lead them out of the woods. But she has also become the vessel for this nature entity that is going to that is trying to metaphorically lead us out of the woods.
Well, and
by bringing us back into the woods.
I think it's critical to mention that, like, her voice was modulated.
Yes.
At the end, too.
Yes, thank you for clarifying that.
It almost sounded like
that.
There was some force beneath.
Something speaking through.
This
her,
is also through Martin's perspective, you know, and he's tripping balls.
Well, and that's the thing, too. I think when I first viewed that, I was kind of unsure about how I felt with that. But, you know, I think you can still take it somewhat ambiguously.
Sure.
In that it could very well still be the forest entity talking through her, but it also could be, you know, they're still fucking tripping,
right?
Yep.
Like there was so many spores just flowing through all of them.
Oh yeah,
that could just be kind of a sort of hallucination.
It's unreliable narrator for sure. There's a lot of
madness,
beauty in that,
you know?
Yeah,
maybe it's Martin starting to, you know, see that in a form of madness.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
What I love is it gave me a lot of the same vibes as the Suspiria remake. Spoilers for Suspiria.
We've talked about it on the podcast.
Mm-hmm. But how, like, our protagonist, like, first off, she starts off a little off frame, and as the film becomes more about her, and she sort of seizes, she transcends into her role. It is revealed that she is the entity that we've been pursuing this entire time, right? Just like how, like, our protagonist in Suspiria turns out to actually be Mother Suspiria, like, in her truest form. And it is, like, something that she has to obtain and become.
Yeah.
And I love that idea, you know, like, the hero, like, is, like, the dragon that they were seeking. And it rules. It's fucking neat. And again, too, like, to present that unreliably was really gratifying, because, like, you can take what you will from it. Like, it's heavily implied that's the case. But, to reference back to, you know, this entity, this person, like, being said to lead people out of the woods, how that applies to her career. She's a park ranger. That's her job.
Exactly.
That's literally her job, to lead people out of the woods. Like, you can read it as literally as you choose. And also, again, like, narratively, like, she has proven to be, like, the most resourceful, the most, like, in the moment, the most capable. Like, as a hero, she has gone through and proved herself in every trial that she has encountered.
And the least, she's the least blinded, too.
Yep.
She's the most objectively clear-headed of every character in the film, so it seems obvious for her to be the one to receive the great wisdom, right?
Yeah, and it's cool because we start the film, like, from Martin's perspective, and she guides us. You know, and, like, and she reveals herself to be, like, the sage that she is.
Because importantly, too, at the same time that Alma comes out of the hallucination, Wendell does, too, and she's just kind of, like, religiously overwhelmed by it. She just kind of falls to the ground.
And says, thank you.
And says, thank you. But, you know, Alma is like, okay, it's time for me to be the shepherd, you know, to guide you out of the forest. And I love that, like, by the end, if there is a true entity or whatever, however you want to read it, that it's not malevolent at all. The horror comes from the human misunderstanding of it and the fact that it is such an unknowable consciousness that to communicate with it, to touch it is madness inducing.
Yeah.
But it has, you know, its motives are pure. It wants to help.
Yeah.
You know, in that regard, another comparison I see to Arrival, and also just like the whole thing with like trying to use unorthodox methods to communicate with an alien consciousness. I saw a lot of those parallels.
Mycelial networks kinda are.
Yeah.
Like they are like alien consciousnesses. Like they communicate and interact with each other in ways that we don't yet really fully understand.
But if you think about it, man, they're really the least alien thing on Earth because they're from the Earth. Mm-hmm. They're not from space, you know? So it's like it's not alien. It's like the most natural thing.
Think about it.
Are y'all ready to rate this?
I am.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I loved the shit out of this. This has been a really fun conversation. I think there's even more stuff that we didn't have a chance to delve into. I think this is a very rich film. I think that after our discussion, I can say definitively that it is my favorite film of 2021 so far. We'll see if it stays there for the rest of the year, but right now, it's right there at the tippy top. This is a 5 out of 5 for me. I don't have any complaints about this.
Yeah, I'm so glad that Ben Wheatley is returning to horror, because I think there's a lot of interesting things he does in the horror genre, and it's just a welcome addition to kind of that bio horror / folk horror / elevated horror. All of those different subgenres, it plays into all of those really well. I found it incredibly tense, like at its core, even beyond kind of the headier themes and ideas it's presenting. It works extremely well as a meat and potatoes kind of tense as hell horror movie, and I respect it a lot for that. It's incredibly strong in its editing and music. The music we didn't really mention much, but it was done by Clint Mansell, who did an incredible job on the soundtrack.
I saw that he's he's done pretty much all of Darren Aronofsky's movies, the scores for just about all of them, as well as Mass Effect 3. I did see that. The music was fantastic.
I thought this movie was awesome. It's an easy contender for one of my favorites of the year. I'm going to give it a 4.5 out of 5, but definitely strong recommendation.
Masterpiece, 5 out of 5.
Yeah, no surprise there.
Mm-hmm. I love this movie. What a great film. Can't wait to watch it again.
I almost put it on today to watch it again before the recording. I didn't.
One of the coolest credit sequences also just got all the ooey gooey like science yummies.
It's like science slides. Very cool. Music fantastic. Just all around a fantastic film. And it will have an average of 4.8 out of 5. So check that shit out if you haven't. Big strong recommendation from all of us. Next week it's Cleveland's pick. And Cleveland has picked a fucking banger for us to talk about.
I haven't seen it. Can't confirm if it's a banger. But
you can trust me.
Trust Tease? Tune in next time when we see American Werewolf in London.
Yes. Did you say American Werewolf?
I did. I will carry that on.
I'm super excited. This is a movie I've been wanting to talk about on the podcast for a while. Just haven't found the right time to pick it, and I'm very glad you did.
So I did.
And I'm super stoked.
It sure doesn't crash and burn, unlike John Landis's other works.
Yeah, well, we can talk
about that. That's a deep cut. I don't know.
So you might say it sticks the Landis.
Get that one.
Yeah, it sticks the Landis.
That's good.
Fuck. But yeah, you can tune back in with us next week for our review of American Werewolf in London.
Werewolf.
Werewolf. I gotta grab the...
Oh, what's going on? Oh, you're grabbing the... Yes, you're paying alms, giving the sponsor shelf a blood offering.
I've knelt before the sponsor shelf, and it has...
It has behooved you with a piece of parchment.
It has returned our sponsor for the week, who's going to be giving us money.
Upon that parchment, it is writ that this episode is brought to you from out of the earth. Billy Bibble's Boiled Bones. Are you...
Oh.
I always start these with "are you," and then I have nowhere to go. Have you ever suffered from bones that are too firm? Suffer no longer. Replace your bones with Billy Bibble's Boiled Bones.
Have you need
They're
bones?
They're a little bit softer for those who just need a gentler touch.
Have you need bones?
Have you need bones?
Have you need bones for your weird forest rituals?
I have need
well,
for bones.
You can seek them out at Billy Bibble's Boiled Bones.
No longer feel boned. Get boned with bones.
Thanks, Billy Bibble. And your bones.
That are boiled.
All right.
Fascinating sponsor.
That'll bring us to the end of this week's episode. If you want to support the show, the best way to do that is to leave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and a nice review.
Or tap deep into your pineal gland and send us a psychic message telling us how
much
you love it.
We're all connected by the mycelial network.
Or both. And then do that and
emphasis,
then rate 5 stars. Yeah.
Emphasis on silly, am I right?
Mm-hmm. We're the myciliest podcast.
That would have been good for the beginning.
It's okay. It's cyclical, you know?
Yeah,
the beginning is the end.
It rhymes, man.
Mm-hmm. Just like poetry.
George Lucas was right.
He is.
You can also support us by becoming a subscriber to our Patreon at patreon.com/podpeoplepod. We got some fun rewards over there. You can get early episodes, or you can even unlock the ability to request us films to talk about on the show. We are cycling in patron picks every few episodes, and we choose a movie at random from that spreadsheet to talk about. So that could be you. Just head over to patreon.com/podpeoplepod. You can also follow us on Twitter at podpeoplepod and at letterboxd.com/podpeoplepod, where you'll find a list of all the films we've talked about on the show with our average ratings and links to those reviews. You can follow me on Twitter and join my mycelial network at Some Spooky Snake.
I'm on Twitter at Mr. Sheets.
And I'm tweeting for Light Arc Studios as we put out progress on It Stares Back. Stay tuned, folks. As a matter of fact, coming soon, there's an event online called Realms Deep. We're going to be putting out a new trailer. Get excited. We're going to be putting out some new content for It Stares Back, The Drowned Queen. So if that's something that strikes your fancy, stay tuned for Realms Deep 2021. There are going to be some other really amazing games featured there as well. And of course, also stay tuned for Dread XP as we put out other cool products as well, like Spookware is coming soon. And it's going to rule. I promise you it will. I've been testing it today. It's fucking great. So go check out Spookware. Go wishlist it on Steam. And that'll be everything for me.
Yeah, just to sort of double down on what Cleveland said, if you have watched this movie in the Earth and you like this kind of dark, psychedelic horror, definitely check out our game, It Stares Back.
Science meets the occult, but
exactly.
Hopefully it's presented in a fun way that isn't just stupid pseudoscience. I think it is. Maybe you will too. Go check it out.
Yeah, definitely. All right, well... thanks for listening, everybody. We appreciate you worming your mycorrhiza into ours and joining the collective pod conscience. Spores.
Succumbing to false pride, abandon the cause.